Erev Tov, everybody. Welcome to our weekly Parsha Shir, which is a pleasure to welcome Rabbi Joel Finkelstein, who we go back to our days in Yeshiva University together. And he's been rabbi for the last 24 years, I believe, in Memphis, Tennessee, where it's now an hour behind us. The rabbi of the Anshei Sfarad Beit El Emet Synagogue in Memphis. He served as the, many years ago, before he came to Memphis, served as the assistant rabbi at Spanish Portuguese Shul in New York City, very prestigious shul, and it's a pleasure. He's very involved in the community, teaching, and all kinds of roles, and educationally and rabbinic. And it's a pleasure to welcome Rabbi Finkelstein back after Shir last year. And I apologize for making him take off his jacket. He didn't have to listen, but he decided to listen. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Bakasha.
Thank you. Well, pleasure to be here, and thank you so much, Rabbi Jay, for inviting me back here again. And it's always good to reconnect with Rabbi Keltman. Yes, indeed, we go back a long way, and it's just a familiar face and a familiar voice. And shkoach to him and all the wonderful things he's doing with Torah Motion up there in Toronto. So I wanted to look at a section tonight of the Torah that we sometimes overlook. And that is, we're not going to be talking about the famous part of Vayishlach, the battle with the angel, or his struggle with Esav, or the triple battle plan, or we're not going to talk about the bizarre Esav episode at the end. We're not going to talk about the very unfortunate and tragic and criminal offense against Dina, and then the assault on the city of Shechem afterwards. It's all very interesting. There's another section of Vayishlach as well. It's a long parsha, and I want to focus on that. I'm going to call it the Beit El narratives, but really it's much more than that. So I'm going to share the screen with you, and I'll show you what we mean, what we are focusing on tonight. So the return to Beit El, the final blessing Yaakov gets, and I'm going to show how it's a turning point in the whole life of Yaakov, and it's a model for us as well. So we're going to deal with the boring part of Vayishlach, and I hope this part will no longer be boring for you when you're done with this presentation. And I have come up with a new approach and a new theory. I hope you find it interesting, and I welcome you to challenge it and tell me that I'm completely off my rocker. I would welcome such a critique. So first, the context, right? Yaakov's on his way home from Shechem, where the disaster happened there, and disaster happened there. And he's told by God to build an altar in Beit El, as promised. Remember, Yaakov promised at the ladder going up to heaven after his dream, he promised he would build an altar in Beit El. So it's okay. You already came home. It's time. Do it. Yaakov cleanses his house of idols, which is very strange that he had those idols, that they had idols. He builds an altar to God in Beit El, as God commands. And then there are all these little pieces here. Devorah dies. Who is Devorah? What is she doing here? And then God appears to him, and we'll see what that blessing is. That's the context. That's the background for the blessing at Beit El. What's the blessing? Vayera Elohim el Yaakov od bavo mi Padan Aram by Varchotam. God appeared to Jacob on his arrival to Padan Aram, and he blessed him. Right? And he said, he said, you're not going to be called Yaakov, you'll be called Israel. And he called his name Israel. Very strange. We know that previously in the parsha, the angel called him Israel, but now God called him Israel. Okay. You had any doubt about the angel encounter? God confirms. I am God, known by these two names, El and Shaddai. Pray Urve. Be fruitful and multiply. Is that a common expression? It's something we find with the other forefathers. Let's take a look. There will be a nation, congregation of nations that comes from you. Kings will come from your loins. Is that an expression we had before? Is this unique to Yaakov? Let's take a look. The land I gave to Abraham and Isaac, I'll give to you. And to your children after you, I'll give them the land. and God parted from him at the spot where he had spoken to him, or actually it says God went up from there at the spot where he had spoken to him. So again, God went up from him at the place where he had spoken to him. So it sounds like God went up directly over his head. Don't forget, in Vayetze, last week, it says, Hine Hashem Nitzav Alav, God was on him. It's an unusual expression. Now Jacob again makes a statue, a pillar, at the site where he was spoken to. And indeed, he was given, oil was anointed on his head, on the head of the monument. Place where God spoke to him. Again, emphasis again and again that God spoke to him and where he spoke to him. Called it Bethel. He thought we already called it Bethel. Strange. Okay. So that's the story. And then what? Well, we'll see more in detail later, but just not to get too bogged down with verses right now, just the overall, then Rachel dies as they move on. He's having this great blessing. He's going to have a lot of children. Then Rachel dies. He has a child. What do you mean he's going to have a lot of children? He should be fruitful and multiply. Only his wife dies in childbirth and Benjamin is born, but that's about it. How can he be fruitful and multiply? All his wives are done with their children. Benjamin is born. Yaakov moves on. He moves to a particular place. And Reuven sleeps with Bilhah, moves her bed, whatever you want to say. Something bad happened that Reuven is later criticized for with Bilhah. And then the 12 tribes are listed. Yaakov goes to Hebron and Yitzchak dies. And Yaakov and Esav bury. So, very good. So someone asked the question. iPad asked the question. So God blesses Yaakov to be fruitful. And does Jacob have any children afterwards? And the answer is he only has a Binyamin. And that's very strange. How could he bless him that he should be fruitful if all he's got is after that is Benjamin? So that's going to be a very important question we're going to ask in a moment. And here are all the questions. Some of the questions. There are many questions. Where I was at Barbanel, I'd come up with 20 more. Why does Yaakov not run home? It's a big question. Many people criticize, the Chazal criticize Yaakov. Chazal don't like to criticize Yaakov. They criticize him for not running home. How many years did he spend not going home? And when he gets home, his mother doesn't appear to be there. He goes home to Yitzchak. What happened to his mother? She was supposed to send for him. What's going on? Is it because she didn't send for him? Why is he not going home? That's going to be a very important question. Why didn't he make a home run or run home? Why is there an altar in Shechem, but God asked him to build one in Beit El? Wait a second. Yaakov, if you go back to the story of the rape of Dinah, before the rape of Dinah, Yaakov built, he bought for $100 or 100 silver, who knows what. He bought a piece of land, then he built an altar. So he already made an altar. God said, no, you have to go to Beit El and build an altar. But you can't build it somewhere else. What's the problem? Why did the rape of Dinah happen after he built an altar? If he's building an altar and everything's going so great, he's calling out in the name of God. I don't remember Abraham building an altar and then his daughter, something gets raped. What's going on? Why did they rid themselves of the idols only in Beit El? What about in Shechem? Okay. What does Devorah's death represent? Also, Yaakov was blessed many times. What does this blessing represent? What's so special about this blessing? And why does Rachel die as they leave Beit El? I thought he's being blessed. And why did Reuven commit his crime only at this particular point? What's going on? So we have a lot of questions. We have a lot of work to do. We got to get to work. We already lost 10 minutes. Got to go. So let's look at the blessing at Beit El, the centerpiece, the actual blessing. We saw it before, right? That's what we started with. And now let's examine that a little. Let's think a little bit about that blessing. Elements in previous blessing and the previous blessing at Beit El, right? What do we see in the previous blessing? And Hashem was standing above him, Alav, on him, really. It's not beside him. And he said, I am the Lord, God, right? The ground which you're lying is assigned to you and your offspring. Okay. Descendants will be multiplied. Now, just to say you have many descendants, that's different. It's like the dust of the earth. Here it says, be fruitful and multiply. That's different. Be fruitful. It's not a promise that you will have many children. It is a command to have many children. So we have to think about the difference. and what that represents. And then he says, you should spread all over. All right. So that we had over here, he says, he's giving him this land. Here it emphasizes that you're going to go all around. Okay. Children will be all over. And all the nations of the earth will be blessed through you. Right? All the nations will be blessed through you. That we don't have. We don't have that over here. Yaakov is given that blessing, but we don't have that over here. The other nations will be blessed through you. Yaakov tends to be more parochial, but in these blessing at the ladder, in the ladder to heaven, does mention that idea. The blessing of Isaac to Jacob when Isaac knew that he was blessing Jacob, and no trickery was going on. He says, "V'kel shakai yivarechotcha v'yafrechav yirbecha." Again, the idea of pru or vru, be many, to see if that's unusual, and you will be a nation, a assembly of peoples. That's similar. We saw that the kahal. I mean, remember that? We had that goyu kahal goyi, a congregation of nations. Usually we associate that with Abraham, that he's a father of many nations. Here's something akin to that. Okay. What about the blessings of Abraham to Abraham, right? So a great nation will be a blessing. All the nations will be blessed through you. So that Yaakov gets that at Beit El in last week's Parsha, not in this week's Parsha. He says, I will make you very fruitful. Doesn't say pru urvu, it's not a command. It's a promise, but the word pru, fruitful, is there. Make you many nations. Abraham was told that kings will come from you, as at Beit El, Yaakov was told, underline, only Yaakov and Avram, I believe if I'm correct, have that blessing that kings will come from you. There's something special about Abraham and a Yaakov. For those who, you know, like to overlook Yitzchak, I don't. I just gave a sermon about, you know, that Yitzchak is not to be overlooked and he has many great qualities. But this analysis seems to support that idea that some of the great blessings go more to Avram and the idea of kingship, greatness to Yaakov, Avram and Yaakov. Note the similarity to Avram. Also, Avram woke up in the morning to the place that he had stood there in front of God. There's this notion that wherever Avraham is, that's where God is. The Kabbalah, the Zohar calls that as a Merkavah Lishkina, that the Avot, Hein Merkavah, they are the resting place of God in this earth. We all aspire to be. That's what Israel, that's what Jews aspire to be. Place where God can rest in this world. Place where God can be in this world. And with Yaakov, it's very prominent. God's above him. God's standing on top of him, literally. The English translation didn't like it, so it said he stood beside him. It doesn't say that. He stood on top of him. And also that in that very place where he was, right? What do we see? That in that very place, God went up from that place where he had spoken to him. And that place where he spoke to him, he called it Beit El. It's the idea that God spoke to him and appeared to him in a very real kind of concrete kind of way, so to speak, is prominent both with Avraham and with Yaakov. What about Pru Urvu? Well, we know, of course, the famous Pru Urvu in chapter 1 and 2, and also in chapter 9 in the flood story. God said to them, Pru Urvu, and fill the earth. So there's always an idea of filling the earth. Here we fill the earth with blessing. Yaakov and Avraham fill the earth with blessing. We fill up the land of Israel, but Pru Urvu is a command. Right? The Ibn Ezra on this week's Parsha says when he tells Yaakov to be fruitful and multiply, it's a blessing as in the account of the creation. Ibn Ezra notices this blessing that Yaakov gets that nobody else gets. It's a blessing to be fruitful and multiply. Pru Urvu. Notice Ibn Ezra calls it a blessing rather than a commandment. Is it a commandment? Okay. What about Isaac? So he tells him that, hold on one second, I just have to. One of my students that I am on. Go to Torah in motion. Okay. So so he tells him that I will bless you because to you I'll give this land. and I'll keep the oath that I promised. The Ramban deals with when Yaakov gets an oath, but it's there. And I will make your children many. Hear beiti, not the word hifreti, pru, but the urvu, many, harbe. And I will give them all these lands, and all the nations will be blessed through you. So that element is there for all three fathers, that all the earth will be blessed through you. However, the word, the commandment or the blessing, be fruitful and multiply, does not appear in either the kingship. What's missing here? The kingship, that kings will come from you and that you'll be a nation, that you'll be many kingdoms or many nations, goyim. The goyim thing, that's missing. Some elements that Isaac does not have. Yaakov picks up some of the elements of his father, the original forefather. Now, one of the iPad asked before, I'm just joking, that how can he be fruitful? He already has 11 or 12 children. Can't be fruitful. He already was fruitful. And he's only going to have one more child. I say 11, 12, because there's 11 tribes, and then it was Dina. So my son, Tani, I'm going to quote my son, Tani, over here. He's a senior at NYU. He said, Harry Babashu, Zain and Kavanah Zakosh Baruch Hu, Vak Leit Es Binyamin. The simple meaning is, he's telling him, you're going to have another child. And by the way, having 12 children is a big deal. Nahor, Avraham's brother, had 12 children. Yishmael had 12 children. So certainly, to have the final number of 12, that's certainly being fruitful. It's a special blessing. But maybe there's a riot that is a proof here that Degidul Bani Madayim Shimpurala. If he could just raise his children in a certain way, that would also be considered Pru or Vru. There's an idea that if you adopt a child, if you that the mitzvah is not just to have children, but to raise them. So even though he already had given birth to children from the tzad of Holada, he had given birth to them physically, biologically, he still had to convey the Mesorat Hadati, the religious tradition, to his children and his grandchildren, and to command them afterwards to do the godly way. The Rav Shamshon Fal Hirsch, what my son said, Rav Shamshon Fal Hirsch says it clearly, my son is aware of that, that Rabbi is what? We have to become greater through our children. We have to reinvent ourselves through our children. Sometimes you become more religious when you have your children. They have to come through our image. Again, any psychologist would say, have to be careful about this. You know, they have to have their own life. But to some degree, their children should be similar to their parents, not only physically, but also spiritually and ethically. And it's incumbent upon the parents to implant within them, to raise the children, and to give them all their spiritual and ethical lessons. The basic principle is it's their responsibility to raise them, not only physically, but also to educate them spiritually. And only then they fulfill the mitzvah of Pru or Vru. My son Tani wanted to argue that this commandment here in our section, where he tells him, pray or ve, which is unusual, it's a singular form, pray or ve, and that Pru is a plural, that y'all should be fruitful and multiply. Here it says you should singularly be fruitful and multiply. That this mitzvah, which is, I think there was one source he found where that actually quotes this rather than other sources for the mitzvah of Pru Avru for Jews. That this is a special Jewish mitzvah of Pru Avru to raise your children in a Jewish way. It's not just a biological act. Why is that important for the story in this narrative? This is not just a vort, or an interesting philosophical thought by my son and Rav Hirsch. There's more to it. Before we get to the full meaning of it and the full context of everything and why this section is so important, I want to note that Tzvi Amor. Tzvi Amor is one of my favorite commentaries. He's an autobiographical commentary. He had lost all his books when he was exiled from Portugal. He originally started in Spain. Then he was in Lisbon. He was in Portugal. He escaped Portugal. He went to North Africa and was very shaken. His children had to convert. I think they came back later. Anyway, he says, to show you the greatness of Yaakov, now and later, it says that God went up from him in the place where he spoke to him. It shouldn't have said, God went up from him. Why does it say on the place where he spoke to him? It shows you the importance. He says, Rashi says, I'm not sure what the point is. Of course, he went up from him. It's, of course, in the place where he spoke to him. Rashi says, I'm not sure. So the Tzvar Mor says 500 years ago, that's the great level Yaakov reached, because other prophets aside from Moshe had sort of a lower level of prophecy. So it says, no, he had a level closer to Moshe. God went up from him where he spoke to him to show you his greatness, that he was, that he had three great prophecies, right? How many times did God bless him, right? It may be more than other forefathers. So many times God appears to him. God appears to him a lot. I like to say that Yaakov lives with angels everywhere, right? He has a dream of angels. Angels appear when he's going out of business with Lavan. He sees a camp of angels. Last week's parsha at the end, he may have sent the angels by Yishlach, beginning this parsha according to Rashi. Malach HaGoel, there's an angel who guards him from all bad things. Yaakov is Mr. Angel. But better than that, God is above him and speaks to him many times. He was so used to Hergel and Nivuah, here's the last line. He wouldn't even tremble when he would see God, but rather God just went up, not like other prophets. And that's what the rabbis say. Shufrid Yaakov kin Shufrid Moshe. Or somewhere, I forget where it is that the beauty of Yaakov is like the beauty of Moshe Rabbeinu. Yaakov is similar to Moshe. When we talk about what happened at Beit El, and if we talk about Yaakov and his achievements as a forefather, talking to someone who reached the level of Avraham, as we saw, and to some degree, the level of Moshe Rabbeinu. Now, back to our story. Prelude to Beit El. We started with the essence of this section here, the blessing. Let's go back. What was before that? Ayom Elokim LeYaakov, Kum Aleh Beit El V'Shev Sham. God tells him, go to Beit El. Stay there. Aseh Sham Mizbech, build an altar to the God who appeared to you when you were running away from Esau. So Yaakov said to his family, you got to get rid of all the idols. Cleanse yourself. Change your clothes. Anybody know when else in Tanakh this happened? Cleanse your clothes.
Matan Torah.
Great. When you got the Torah, we'll get back to it later. Thank you very much. Now, and then come on, everybody. We'll go up to Beit El, and I'll make an altar to the God who answered me in my tzaras, and he was with me in the way. And they gave Yaakov all their Elohei Anechar, all the gods of strange gods that were in their hands. The Zamim, Asher Bazeh. They also took their earrings, strange, I don't know, it alludes to the golden calf. We may come back to that. And Yaakov buried them under the tree, Shechem, where he had built the altar. He buries that over there and goes to Beit El. Shechem is a place where you bury the idols. Now we're going somewhere else. Good. Let's see. Someone wants to know, wasn't Rachel already pregnant and showing when God blessed Jacob to be fruitful? How do you know that? Interesting. Could be. How do you know that? Let's take a look at that. Let's see if you have come back about that. How do you know that? By Esau, and they went. And then, it's very strange. Yaakov said, they're all going to kill us. So then God says, no, come over here. And then he gets rid of the idols. And then, on only then, it says, everybody was afraid of the Jews, and they didn't run after Yaakov. What was happening until now? It's like there was a delay, and they were afraid that everyone was going to kill them. Then Hashem says, hey, why don't you come to Beit El? Go to Beit El, get rid of the idols. And then all of a sudden, now the Gentiles, right, were running after, it's almost like a cartoon. They're all running after him, running, and like they stop in midair. Yaakov built an altar, gets rid of the idols, and then everyone stopped running after him. It's bizarre. It doesn't belong here, it belongs after the story. Very bizarre. Let's continue. So Yaakov comes to Luz, which is really Beit El. And he calls it Beit El. He and all the people with him. What's remarkable about that? The Chol Ha'am Asher Imo. Anything remarkable about that? So, a big deal. Well, I'm Asher Imo. Yeah, you have it all the time. When the Jews travel, they call the Am. A big deal, right? It's a very big deal. It's the first time Jews are called an Am, a nation. What happened at Beit El? What happened in this boring section? The Jews become an Am. He becomes like Abraham. The people become like a nation. Even Shem Yisbeach, he builds an altar and he calls it Beit El, because that's where God appeared to him again and again when he was running away from his brother. And then Devorah dies. She's buried under a tree. There are all these trees. There are all these monuments. And he calls it Alon Bachut, the tree of crying. What is that there for? Then God appeared to him again and he blessed him. He appeared and he blessed him. So again, I'm sorry, I'm going, you know, going backwards, right? So these are all the things that happened. And then God blessed him. And then we started with that blessing that he gave him. But so notice this, that God tells him to go away. And only then when he goes toward Beit El and gets rid of the idols, then God puts the fear in the nations who were running after him. And then he comes, and with a nation, he becomes a nation. And then somehow Devorah dies. What does that got to do with it? And then he blesses him. So let's think about some of the things we just read. Make an altar, right? Asei sham mizbeach. A very specific commandment that Yaakov had. Is there another forefather who gets a mitzvah? Any other forefather who has mitzvot, right? So obviously, Avraham had what?
Avraham at Har HaMoriah.
Right, to offer Yitzchak as an offering, and of course, the very first words, Lech Lecha Mi'atzcha, to go to Israel. Yitzchak, offhand, I didn't look at it carefully, offhand, Gur Ba'aretz, that's what he tells him to stay. It's like a Shev Altase. Stay where you are. Don't go any further. Don't go to Egypt. I don't know that Yitzchak has any commandments. So the idea that he has a mitzvah, this could be very significant. Of course, you later have the Gid Anasheh, which is...
Brit Milah.
Right, the Brit Milah, good. So Avraham has these mitzvot. Again, in the Rambam, Yitzchak institutes Mincha and Meiser, but in terms of God telling him what to do, Avraham and Yaakov have mitzvot. So if you ask, you know, who's the father of mitzvot? Avraham and Yitzchak have mitzvot. Again, there's the whole Rashi, there's the whole Rambam in Perashim Shnayas, and we don't do mitzvot because of this, but we do it because of Sinai. But in terms of somebody who had a mitzvah, this again shows uniqueness of Avraham and Yitzchak and Yaakov. Avraham and Yaakov. And what's Devorah's role? So the Jerusalem Talmud, the Jerusalem the translations, Pseudo-Jonathan, whatever it is, one of the commentaries, one of the translations, Aramaic translations, Umita Devorah pedagogic to Rivka, that the pedagogue, the teacher of Rivka died. So some want to say that it's the teacher of Rivka. So you could view this, I think that Rabbi Nell says, is that there's a monument in Israel somewhere to the teacher of Rivka. There's a monument to education. It's the UFT. It's the monument to education in Israel. That it's that. How does Yaakov become Yaakov? How does he become Avraham? How does he become a forefather? Because he honors the pedagogue. Or we could take it a totally different direction. Rabbi Ezra Bick at Yeshiva University, Yeshiva Har Zion, said he represents all that was before. He buried the past. Meineke Rivka, all the things that the Rivka's maid, who is from Laban's house, who's no good, they were buried over there and they buried it with the idols and were burying the past. That's a completely different interpretation. So I have two possibilities. One is that Devorah shows his focus on Pruvu, prayer of A, my son's interpretation, that he's gonna be a good educator now. And now she was buried. Or that it was at this moment, let's take a look. So, right, on his way home, he buries the idols and Devorah has to die. Or no, as he's getting ready to go to Beit El and cleanse his house and be the true educator, he honors one of the great educators, Rivka's teacher. Rivka's great. Her teacher must have been great too. So he honors the educator. So there's something here either about putting the past to bed or about honoring the good part of the past represented by Devorah. Okay. Now, to be like Avraham. What does it mean to be like Avraham? Because Hashem says, I know Avraham. I like him. Why? Because I know him, that he's going to command his children and his household after him. And they'll keep the way of God. to do righteousness and justice in order to bring on Avraham what he told him. So if Yaakov can be not just like Avraham personally, but to transmit pedagogically, right? As like teacher, like Devorah, to his children to teach them the right way, which may relate to the fact that Yaakov rebukes Shimon and Levi and says, that's not good. So we say, oh, that's terrible. How could we have murderers in our camp? No, it's not important if you have murderers. Of course, there are always, every nation has murderers. The question is, what do we say about them? If you say, oh, that's the way it goes, you know, another shooting in Memphis, that's not good. But if you say that this is horrible, this is an embarrassment, you rebuke your children, then he may be on the Abrahamic way. Rabbi Drummond, in his book on Genesis, wants to claim that this shows that he's taking that Abrahamic role. He's taking the active role of Israel. And I want to say it's an Abrahamic role, a role of commanding his children after him. So he's like Abraham. Now the aftermath. After this story is over, hold on a second, I just want to include another student. Charlie, I'm on a class. You can listen. Please don't say anything. You can listen. Put yourself on mute. Listen to the class. Now the aftermath. So Yaakov puts in a stone altar. He puts up a pillar. A lot of pillars here. He buries the idols under a tree, and Devorah is buried under a tree, and his wife is going to be buried, and now he puts a monument for the vision of God, and the place where God spoke to him once again, a stone monument, and he anoints it with oil, and Yaakov called that place Beit El. Then they went from Beit El, and before they got to Ephrat, Rachel's having trouble giving birth. So the person before wanted to claim that he gets this blessing while she's pregnant. Could be. Depends how long they were there. Could be. So she's having trouble. So when she's having trouble, the midwife says, don't worry. You have another son. You know, she knew that she wanted to have sons like her sister. So as she's dying, she calls him son of my affliction, something like that. And her father called him Benjamin. So again, I think it's Rabbi Grumman wanted to say that he's asserting himself. All the other children were called by the women. Now he takes some authority here, and he says, I'm going to call him my own name, and I'm going to call him something positive, my son of my right hand or the son of the south. Tam and Rachel, and Rachel dies, and she's buried on the way there, and Yaakov puts up another matzeva, another monument, and that's where Rachel is buried to. And we're not done. All the boring stuff goes on. And hold on, I'll explain each line here. We'll be explained in a moment. Very significant. And Israel journeyed on. And they pitched a tent beyond. He pitched his tent, or they pitched their tent. It's not clear if it's individually or collectively. Beyond Migdal Eder. So I want to give a shout out to my friend who recently passed away, Rabbi David Sykes. He makes an attempt in this book on the patterns and Genesis and beyond. Makes an attempt to try to figure out what this Migdal Eder is. It's very difficult. It's not a place that appears in other places. We're going to give a theory tonight, if you hang on. And so he puts his tent over there. Who cares? What's going on? What is that talking about? And when he was in that land, Reuven went and he slept with the Bilhah, the concubine of his father, and Jacob heard interruption at the end of a verse, in the middle of a verse, for some reason. Children are 12. And it goes to list the 12 children of Yaakov, because now he finally achieved the 12 children, and then they go on to Hebron. There he goes back to his father, he sees his father, he dies, Esav, Yaakov, very different. End of story. Now I'm going to put it all together. Remember, we had all these different questions. Let's go back to the questions a second, and we're going to answer all of them right here. Watch this. Why does Yaakov not run home? We're going to answer that question. Why is there an altar in Shechem? But God asked him to build an altar somewhere else. We'll find out in a minute. Why the rape of Dinah happened after he built an altar? We'll find out. Why did they rid themselves of idols only in Beit El? We'll find out. Why does Devorah's death, what does it represent? We talked a little bit. We'll see some more. Yaakov was blessed many times. What does this blessing represent? We'll find out. Why, we talked a little bit. Why does Rachel die as they leave Beit El? We'll have to find out. Why did Reuven commit this crime now? We'll find out. Here we go. Hold on to your seatbelts. My new theory. You've heard it here, folks. This is Joel Finkelstein, new theory. What is really going on here? What we're talking about here five stages of Jewish history. Number one, the altar at Shechem. Number two, the altar at Beit El. Ephron, where Rachel dies. Migdal Eder, something's going on over there. Let's figure it out. And then Hebron, five stages. Now, the altar in Shechem, each one has its own calamity. You know, they build an altar at Shechem. Look in the chapter there where Dina's raped. Before she's raped, he builds an altar. Very bizarre. If you build an altar, you figure that gives you, you know, you build a shul, you make a mikveh, you have an eruv. Nothing bad should happen anymore. There's many rapes going on here at this point, right? But somehow, it's all ruined, and they have to leave. It's destroyed, so to speak. There's like a churban beis hamikdash. There's a destruction because the rape of Dina, the trickery, and the murder of Shimon Levi. It's murder and rape. This is right. This is like a Harlequin novel or something. It's bad news. Number two, the altar at Beit El, approved by God, right? Here, the idolatry is removed. Devorah is removed, or Devorah is celebrated, right? But someone dies. Someone dies, and again, is that good? Maybe it's good. The idolatry is removed. Implying that at Shechem, the idolatry was not removed over there. Ephrat, Rachel dies. Why does she die? Well, the other Ramban theory, she wants to make Jacob's marriage kosher, right? Picture Jacob coming home. Hey, Dad, look, I married a Jew. Two Jews. So, according to Ramban, he can't, as soon as he gets to Israel, somebody has to die because he can't be married to two sisters. In Israel, the laws of morality take reign. Otherwise, you can't inherit the land of Israel if you're immoral. Or, and I hate to suggest this, but you know, if you're getting rid of idols, who has idols? Right? Who has an idol? Rachel. Again, some people say it's a divination tool. So all right, so she's a witch. You know, again, Mechilas Kvoda, I love Rachel. My daughter's name is Rachel. My grandma's name is Rachel. But there is something to it, that maybe there's some sin of idolatry in Rachel. So that has to be removed. Or in Ephrat, let's not focus on her death. Let's focus on what happened. As Jacob says, look, my son of my right hand is born. It's a good thing. I mean, she died, but this is a good thing. Something good comes out of it. So is that what Ephrat is about? What is Ephrat about? And what is Rachel about? So we need to look at that. Then there's Migdal Eder. Now, what is Migdal Eder? So Rav Hirsch says, that when Rachel was alive, Yaakov was with everybody. He was with Leah, he was otherwise. But after she died, he separated himself from everybody. So Rav Hirsch imagines that after Rachel dies, he becomes like an old widower and sort of like a monk. Which is interesting. I don't know if it's true, but it's interesting. And what happens in Migdal Eder? There's a sin there too, and a calamity. Sin of Reuven, or sexual or political. Then Hebron, he's reunited with his father, not with his mother. Very tragic. It's a great tragedy. It doesn't mention Rivka because it was so tragic. He comes home and his favorite mother is not even his father. We don't even know if his father even loves him. So this doesn't quite tell you the five stages of history. Now I'm going to lay it out for you exactly. And I need your help also. The altar at Shechem was destroyed by the rape of Dina, and the trickery and the murder of Shimon Levi. Which kingdom is that parallel to? If we want to say that this is parallel to some stage of Jewish history, what stage of history is this common to? It's an altar that's built in the north, but then it's destroyed. The early stage of Jewish history, where there's a major altar, but it's not the permanent altar. It has to be destroyed. What's that?
That's something in Sefer Shoftim?
Right. Maybe it's the Tkufa of the Shoftim, the period of the Shoftim. And you might say, you know, Ishko Yashabina, what's the theme of Shoftim? Everybody did whatever they wanted to do. So somebody's raped and somebody else murders everybody and Yaakov is trying to tell them something, but they're not listening. Sounds like a little bit like Eli. Lavdil. So, it could be that period, right? It could, right? It could, so, and Shiloh. Shiloh is the northern altar, which lasts for hundreds of years, but then it's destroyed. In the keynotes on Tisha B'Av, we refer to Chet Shiloh. There was the Hurban of Shiloh. Shiloh was a great place where Shmuel was tutored and mentored, and then it was destroyed. And it was a great tragedy. So this is the first altar. It's in the north. It's not really the chosen place of God, right? Jacob didn't say, I'm going to build an altar in Shechem. He builds an altar over there. Don't forget, when they came to Israel, they also built an altar in Shechem. That's another possibility. They were told, you know, the Har Gerizim and Har Eval right next to Shechem could be. That's that altar. But I'd like to say that there's all this destruction going on as well. There's murder. There's Arias, according to those who want to blame Dina a little bit. Again, I don't want to blame the victims of rape, God forbid. But there is this idea that Dina was not careful with who she was hanging out with and got into trouble. But anyway, it says that he came there to Shechem. He bought some land. He paid money for it. So one commentator said it was similar to Arvana, the Jebusite. Then David bought the land, right? But this doesn't last. This is not the Jebusite. This is not Temple Mount bought by David. This is something that they move away from. And he builds an altar. He calls it the God of Israel. It somehow doesn't last. Shiloh is in the north, right? I'm saying that this altar is parallel to the period of Shiloh, which was the period of the judges, as the woman pointed out. And what is your name?
Debbie Sondheim.
Oh, Debbie. Yes. Yes, how are you? Yes, from SAR, yes. And destroyed by the sons, not listening to their fathers, right? Shiloh was destroyed by the sons not listening to their father, and the fathers not rebuking their sons. Lack of justice, the story of Eli. Or maybe it's Giluy Ariyot, maybe it's a sin, maybe it's the north, maybe it's the first temple being destroyed for Giluy Ariyot, for the somehow licentiousness, which perhaps Dina was engaged in before she got into trouble, right? You don't get raped at the bar until you go to the bar. You know, so I say so with great hesitancy. Again, I don't want to blame Dina. Maybe murder, if the Shimon and Levi were unjust in their killing, then it's a place of murder. If the next altar removed idolatry, then there must have been what during this altar? What must have been there? It's been idolatry. So what do we have? Giluy Ariyot, Shfichas Damim, and Avodah Zarah. All the three worst sins and worst crimes, they're all there. So let's see, we have a question there in the chat. Let's look at that later. Yes, interesting question. So in Shiloh, we may have the three cardinal sins. Dina may be engaged in some light form of immorality, certainly. Shem, this fellow who raped her was. Brothers are engaged in some form of murder, although they would deny that. And it was obviously idolatry because they didn't remove their idols yet. So Shiloh cannot stand too much idolatry. Period of judges, that we pointed out. Period of judges, a lot of idolatry. That's the first stage. So then God says, get out of there. This is not the altar of our dreams. You dreamt of Beit El, you promised Beit El. Now, what does Beit El remind you of? We associate Beit El. It's true, there's a place called Beit El. My good friend, right, Baruch Gordon, give you a tour of Beit El. That's very nice, but we associate it when he has that dream. We don't associate it with the city of Beit El near Nablus and Shechem. What do we associate Beit El with? We know it's in Jerusalem, right? The whole question exactly, how could he have the dream about Jerusalem if he's in Beit El, right? And where is it? You know, some say, I think sort of Radak maybe says something akin to this, that when he had the dream, he was dreaming about Jerusalem. He was in Beit El, but he was dreaming about Jerusalem. So it's akin to Jerusalem. And what did the first altar lack? It lacked the removal of the idolatry, and also if it's a center of teaching, right? If Jacob, in order to be Jacob, you have to be a teacher, like a pedagogue, like Devorah, right? In Beit El, Devorah dies because that's not a bad thing. It's not a calamity so much because Beit El is the ultimate place. Beit El, there wasn't a calamity. Beit El, there was something good. We made a monument to education. And where, which temple is a center for education for the whole world? Jerusalem. So this is Jerusalem, a chosen place, chosen later on by God and David, here by Jacob when he makes a vow. Why is the blessing of kings mentioned? Obvious, right? What, in this particular place, he gets the blessing of what? Blessing of kings. Why now? It's Jerusalem. Jerusalem is associated with Tzemach David Abdecham Razmiach Yerushalayim Rechab Rachamim Dashu Chumdechag Shizbarta Rechab Rechisei David Mirat Tochatachim. What's David doing? That's the next bracha. No, he mentioned Jerusalem. He mentioned David. Right, Zvi Gamet says, where else do we find purification? Debi Sondheim already told us. Where do we find purification and removal of idolatry before an event? Sinai. And what's the connection of Jerusalem to Sinai? The temple is the perpetual Sinai. Sinai was a one-moment event, but it's a perpetual Sinai. When you go to Jerusalem, you also have to cleanse yourself, right? Now we have a second place, a third place. We had the destroyed Shiloh, the beautiful Jerusalem, Beit El. Now we have Ephrat. What do we make of this? What does this represent? Rachel dies to make Jacob's marriage kosher. Something's still not kosher. She's in Beit El, got two wives. And they're sisters. No problem. Or to remove the idols. Right? Maybe Rachel is associated with those idols that she stole from her father. Or to complete the tribes. Rachel dies in a positive sense. She dies in a sacrificial act to bring about the birth of Benjamin. So now Benjamin is born in tragedy. Who does this make you think of? That there's a birth of something over here, but it dies, and it's Benjamin. How is Benjamin associated with birth of something great, but then the death of it?
Malchus?
Right. Which Malchus? Which king?
Shaul.
So maybe it's an allusion to Benjamin's greatest achievement. He's the father of who? And then he dies. Just like Rachel. There's a death, there's a birth and a death. Birth, a burst of something good and new, but also a death. What other legacy does Rachel leave? Rachel's also the mother of Joseph. Joseph's the mother of Ephraim and Manasseh. Ephraim and Manasseh, what legacy is that? The legacy of the northern tribes. And the northern tribes also suffer some sort of a death. The northern tribes, so maybe an allusion to the northern tribes. Now, Migdal Eder, this is a tough one because Migdal, what does that represent? Migdal Eder, a tower of sheep, of a flock? What is this? So Rav Hirsch said that it was a monastic moment. And what happens there? In Migdal Eder, if you recall from the list of tragedies, in Migdal Eder, the sin of Reuven. Now, the sin of Reuven can be interpreted as political or sexual. Right? For years, I always thought it was sexual. Right? I don't know. He's some kind of weirdo. He decides to sleep with his stepmother. But then, if you look at the JPS translation, they and then not translation, but the commentary brings of some ancient Near Eastern material, and you don't need to go that far. Just look at Adoniyahu, who tried to sleep with Avishag HaShunamit until Solomon realized that that was not a good idea, and also Avshalom, who slept with his father's concubine. When you want to take over from your father, you sleep with the concubines of your father. So it's a political move. So it's a political move. He knows that Judah or Benjamin or Joseph are going to take over. So he's upset about that. So he tries to make a political coup, and it's part of the needless hatred. It's part of perhaps the Vayeshev story of Reuven and the brothers and their jealousy and needless hatred. Of course, that makes us think of the second temple, which is destroyed for needless hatred. And it all starts with the brothers and with Reuven and the jealousy over the different mothers. Hebron is great. Reunited with Isaac, it's ideal. Esav comes to bury also. Maybe it's a vision of the after of the world and the end of days when Esav or Jacob will come to Esav and it'll be great, right? They're reunited and right and sorry, a product of the 70s and 80s, right? Reunited and it feels so good, right? And it's terrific and everything's really great. He finally comes home. He finally comes home. And what stage of Jewish history would that represent? Probably the ideal stage, the ultimate stage, the messianic stage. So then, now let me, if it wasn't clear, if until now I've been hinting at it, let's make it clear. The altar of Shechem is the Mishkan of Shiloh. It's the tabernacle of Shiloh, which lasts for many years, the period of the judges. It's destroyed by the rape of Dinah and the trickery and the murder of Shimon and Levi, and maybe the idols that they still have. Two, we have Jerusalem and David. Here idolatry is removed. Devorah is removed. But she also represents the old world, or Devorah is celebrated as the great pedagogue because there's teaching and there's learning and there's emanating teachings from Jerusalem. Now, number three is out of order if you say it's Saul, but if you say it's a northern kingdom, then it's not the anti-David. Three is not David, but the Rachel part, which unfortunately, even though a lot of us love Rachel and she's our favorite matriarch and all that, but she's the mother of the losing kingdom. Maybe it refers to that. She dies, right? And maybe it alludes to that. Migdal Eder is maybe the second temple because it's a time of strife between brothers. You think Aristobulus and his combatant there in the Maccabee period. Anyway, and Hebron equals Mashiach, reunited with Yitzchak. Now, so that's my theory. Hope you like it. We can glad to shoot holes in it. We get to question and answers. Hang on 1 second. What's the point? What's the point of all this? Number one, the goal is for Jacob to become an Av, to become a great leader. This is a point which other authorities, I think Ramidan, I think Rav Bik, I think Tzvi Grumman, a lot of the Grush crowd, they, my yeshiva, make this point that they return to the status of their forefathers. This image of going back to the status of your forefathers is an image that Ramban famously trumps in the beginning of Shemot, where he says that by the end of the book of Exodus, the Jews will reach the level of their forefathers because they'll have a tabernacle where God will rest. Jacob reaches this level where God rests with him again. But there's stuff he has to do. You got to get rid of the idols. You got to rebuke your children. You got to bring your children into the fold. The rabbis were not kidding when they said he was worried at his deathbed that some of them didn't worship idols. So they said, no, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, don't worry, we still worship you. But it wasn't a piece of cake for God to achieve that in those pagan days. So the goal is to go back. And through this process, Shechem, he does not reach that level. In Beit El, he does reach that level. Could be he needs additional tikkun, the death of Rachel. And then there is a step back. Maybe according to the Rav Hirsch, he reaches a higher level of some monasticism at that point. I'm not sure I want to say that. So now we can answer a very important question that everybody wants to know the answer to. And only because you came tonight, you know the answer. Why didn't he come home earlier? This is my punchline. Why didn't he come home earlier? After all, come over. Come right home. As soon as you get across the border, right? Never do that. Never go to Israel and you don't call your first cousin within the first 15 seconds of your arrival. And then you're caught on Ben Yehuda or in a coffee shop with some friend of yours from the Chalah or something. And your cousin is there, right? It's terrible. It's a great travesty. So why didn't he come home earlier? So we have to learn something about coming home. When you go away, to become a forefather, you got to come back a forefather. You got to come back with lots of sheep, come back with the right wives, and in this case, the right wife, not the right wives, because you can't be married to two sisters. It's immoral. It's illegal in the land of Canaan for Jews. And you got to get rid of your idols. Until he becomes Avraham, he's not ready to come home. He didn't make it big yet. He went home. He went there to make it big. And until you make it big, you can't come home. Also, of course, this is telling us that these stories are all Masiyavo Siman Abanim, that everything that happened was a sign for the children. Amital says we need to realize that we are part of a beginning. The beginning of the modern Orthodox community in America, the beginning of flowering Judaism in America, the beginning of the state of Israel and religious communities there. Everything we do will be watched. How many years do you go to yeshiva? How many years learn YU? How many learn after YU? How many years learn for Smicha? Who do you marry? What do you do? How do you have a wedding? We are establishing these things. Every move we make will be watched. Every move Yaakov makes turns into a period of history later on. When you're a forefather, you got to be careful about it. And finally, if you didn't appreciate this whole Bethel boring section, you realize now that it's a turning point. It's a model. The whole period of the five stages is a model for the future. You can't have it. We learn that you can't have an altar until your idols are tossed. We know this from all the prophets. You can't worship God if you've got idols under your camel. You can't be a forefather until you follow the Torah, and you can't be married to two wives who are sisters. You have to teach your children with the pedagogia, and you have to keep your vow. You have to return home and follow God's word, and then and only then can you come home with your head held high, and only then you become a forefather. Any questions or comments? Let me just take the comments from the line first. I see my friend Harry Seeline. Hold on a second. iPad always has something good to say. Let's see. Good. Let's see. Rachel dies. Women are not commanded to not marry the husband of a sister, but men are commanded not to marry two sisters. So the sin is Jacob's. Why punish Rachel? Yeah, I'm not sure about that. Yeah, that's probably right. Let's look in the Sefer Achinuch and say, who violates these incestuous relations? Right, it's the man who does the marrying, so she's passive. Could be. Good. And then, what else? Harry Seeland, first name Rachel Oni Aleph. Strength Own. Oh, Oni. I don't know. Aninut is with an Aleph, so I'm not sure about that. Question? I'll take questions from the phone later. Thank you. All right. Any last comments?
All right. Thank you. If anybody wants to ask, Rakasha. I mean, I think in the Bible, in the Torah world, the men and the woman was, you know, it's male dominated. So, in other words, it's looked at always from the perspective of the male. Doesn't, in other words, it's maybe Yaakov sinned, but in other words, it's his wife who died. In other words, he married two, if you take that approach, you're not allowed to marry two sisters. And when they came back to Israel, you couldn't have two sisters. So, okay, it was him who had to lose a wife. It's not so much, I don't think the Torah looks at it as a punishment so much. I mean, the whole comment, the Ramban's a very sort of strange comment, you know, what you could marry two sisters outside of Israel, couldn't marry in. But if you want to take that approach, I think just the approach we're looking at it from really the whole Yaakov's perspective.
I could add to that, Rabbi Kelman, that some say she died because he made an oath that.
Correct. He made an oath that whoever took the idol should die. That's correct. That these things happen other. And why did Yiftach's daughter have to die, you know, and you have this all the time. It's a whole, although in Bereshit, the women tend to be very strong, but okay, that's a whole other discussion. But okay, thank you. Okay, Bakasha, thank you for, and Shabbat Shalom. And next shiur, tomorrow morning, of course, my shiur on the Siddur, 9:30, we're in the middle of Birkat HaShachar, if you like to do that, 9:30. And Then continuing next week, our regular shiur, Rabbi Liebtag, 11:15 on Sunday morning. As I mentioned, I sent out an email earlier today, Rabbi Bazaka Mamzakitain Shiur Bivrit, on Neis Pach Hashemen, Shel Elisha, Eliyahu, and the Maccabim, Zeya Ba'achad, Ba'acharat Zarayim, Ba'yom Sheni. And then I continue with our regular shiurim all week, getting ready for Hanukkah soon. So, okay, everybody have a good night. Shabbat Shalom. Hope to see you soon. And like I always say, invite a friend. That's the most important thing you can do from your end is your admission ticket to all the classes. Thank you. And okay, always willing to hear your comments and suggestions.